We'll hear argument now on number 948769, Tommy L. Rutledge versus United States. Mr. Levinson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this case presents the question of what limits the Double Jeopardy Clause places upon the punishment to be imposed upon a defendant found guilty of violating 21 U.S.C. Section 848, the Continuing Criminal Enterprise Statute, and Section 846, the Drug Conspiracy Statute, where the same conduct constitutes the conspiracy and the in-concert element of Section 848.
Is it the Double Jeopardy Clause in the constitutional sense, or simply a concept that's somewhat like double jeopardy when we're interpreting congressional intent?
The court's analysis has incorporated the Double Jeopardy Clause of the Constitution. Historically, there have been cases decided without reference to that, and then there have been a number of cases which rely on the Double Jeopardy Clause.
But do all parties concede, or at least do you agree that if Congress wanted multiple or cumulative punishments for the two crimes, that they could constitutionally enact a provision that would secure that objective?
Yes, Your Honor. Under Missouri v. Hunter and a long line of cases from this court, that is clearly the case.
So then we're really talking about what Congress intended rather than double jeopardy, are we not?
Well, what Congress intended in the multiple punishments context defines the parameters of the double jeopardy protection.
Which really means there isn't any constitutional question involved. If Congress can provide whatever it wants and double jeopardy accordingly recedes whatever Congress has provided.
Well, double jeopardy does not impose limitations on Congress, it's true. It's been analyzed to impose limitations upon the courts in imposing Congress's will. Whether it's actually necessary given the presence of the Due Process Clause or even the body of the Constitution, the relative authority granted under Article 1 or Article 3, insofar as my client is concerned, he would be as happy to have one of these convictions vacated under any of those rubrics. But historically, looking at the cases, they have analyzed these situations under the Double Jeopardy Clause.
But then if we're concerned with Congress's intent,
yes,
as you agreed, then why would Congress intend to put the prosecutor at risk of having no conviction, let's say the CCE conviction gets wiped out on appeal, if the conspiracy conviction has not been entered? Why would we attribute such a will to Congress?
I don't think you should attribute such a will to Congress, and I don't believe that that is what would happen. Our suggestion as to what should happen in a situation, it's clear under this court's decision in Ball that the prosecutor is entitled to charge both, to present evidence as to both, to put both before the jury, and the court is entitled to accept a verdict back from the jury with respect to both. If the jury comes back and enters guilty verdicts with respect to both, our position is that it would be incumbent upon the district court to enter a vacatur with respect to one or the other in that court's discretion. And then when the entire case goes up on appeal, and we would assume that the defendant, having been found guilty, would take an appeal, both the guilty verdict, the judgment entered upon the conviction on, for instance, the CCE, and the vacatur that the district court entered on the conspiracy would be before the appellate court. It would be incumbent upon the defendant to argue with respect to both of those counts, everything that he has, because the appellate court, having jurisdiction over the entire case and all the orders therein, because the appeal is from a final appeal, if it determined that the CCE count should be reversed based on some element of CCE or some aspect of the case pertaining to an element that distinguishes it from the underlying conspiracy, the appellate court would have the authority to reverse the vacatur on double jeopardy grounds at the same time.
How would that work if there was no judgment entered on the conspiracy count?
Well, but there would be a final judgment entered in the case, and in the line on the judgment form, it would say jury verdict vacated with respect to the conspiracy. And then the appellate court could simply reverse the vacation of that and remand to the district court.
The government would have to appeal that, though, to get the vacatur reversed. When, I mean, the defendant isn't going to say reverse the vacatur.
Well, the defendant won't say that. It's my understanding that a final appeal, because all orders merge in the final judgment order, the court would have the authority.
Well, merge, you just used the word that the Second Circuit, what you described seems to be what the Second Circuit's position is, and yet in your brief you reject that.
Well, I reject that because the Second Circuit's approach involves entering judgments of conviction on two counts, when we believe under the Ball decision that judgments of conviction should be entered under only one of the counts that we believe is Congress's intent and that we believe is backed up by the force of the Double Jeopardy Clause.
But isn't this all just formalism? If your end result is that the Court on Appeal could reinstate the verdict on the conspiracy count in the event that the CCE conviction were reversed on a ground peculiar to that charge.
Perhaps it may appear to be a formalism from the standpoint of the court, but from the standpoint of the defendant who has a double jeopardy interest here, he will have stood trial in public, perhaps in his community, and under the Second Circuit's means of addressing this issue, he will have the additional stigma, which the court mentioned in Ball, of having two judgments of conviction entered, really upon one offense.
You think the vacatur erases, washes off that stigma? This is not formalism?
Yes.
He is walking around in the community with two convictions instead of one conviction and a conviction plus the vacatur. That's the difference.
Right.
That's not formalism.
No.
Why is there any additional stigma when the second offense is essentially a lesser included? I mean, he's already got all the stigma he can get from the first one. The second is stigmatically redundant, isn't it?
But no, Your Honor, we don't think so. I think.
Well, why not?
Because.
What do they know about him as a result of the second conviction that they don't know about him as a result of the first?
That he's been convicted on two significant drug offenses, which are in fact one and the same. That he has received two life sentences. And the newspaper reports at the time of the sentencing noted the number, the conviction total, with respect to my client. And it seems to me, although I've been involved in the legal system nearly 20 years now, that for people who are not, when they read the papers and see that someone has received not one but two life sentences, they glean from that he committed not one but two exceptionally heinous crimes. And under I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was simply going to say, under Congress's definition, based on our position, there has been only one offense here. The lesser included is not to be punished separately. It's not to be taken as a separate offense.
District court order that the lesser offense be simply suspended. He would suspend entering judgment. I don't think that would work because then you couldn't have both appeals.
My concern with the suspension and why I respectfully suggest that the vacatur is a more satisfactory solution is because suspending the count sort of leaves it out in somewhere in never-never land.
Sort of like a springing noose.
Something I never really understood in law school myself.
Well, what do we do in the present case?
Our request with respect to this would be that you remand to the district court with direction that one of the two convictions be vacated.
Which one?
That would be up to the district court.
Well, but how is it supposed to work? That's what I can't figure out in this case. The judge gets a piece of paper, and the piece of paper says, judgment on 846, and then there's a blank or something. I mean, normally he'd fill in convicted, all right? Then 848, he'd fill in judgment of conviction. It's this piece of paper called a judgment. And in your opinion, how should it read? After all, I mean, it sounds very technical and very formal. If he puts the wrong one and then on appeal, the other one's reversed or something, you know. And what happens when one party thinks that they are lesser included and the other doesn't? I mean, isn't the simplest thing just say, judge, fill in both, convicted. Do that. Just fill it both in, convicted.
And
the collateral consequences will take care of themselves. You say you wouldn't be able to count it twice, and later recidivism statutes, etc.
But That might be the simplest approach.
All right, so now what is your approach? How would you?
My approach, which is suggested, I believe, by Ball, is that the district court exercise its discretion.
But you say that. I'm a district judge, pretend. And I would say, since I have that much experience, I'd ask you, what do you want me to do?
In the normal course, I believe you would enter judgment on the greater offense and vacate the lesser included.
So I'd enter judgment 848 convicted. Okay? And I enter judgment on 846. I say strike it out. Do I say acquitted? I don't put acquitted. I cross it out. Okay? Now what happens is that you appeal. And lo and behold, you discover that the money wasn't used in an enterprise or something, and so that's reversed. Now what happens?
Well, the appellate court then would say that because the government did not satisfy the requirements to establish a CCE, and there is no CCE conviction, the vacatur entered on the conspiracy conviction.
There was no vacatur, and then no judgment was ever entered on it. That's what you say was the appropriate thing. You said the district judge should convict on only one count.
And vacate the jury's verdict on the other.
You don't vacate the jury's verdict, you just don't enter judgment on it, right?
Well, I believe the jury's verdict is, as a matter of course, entered on the docket, and the docket entry would then be vacated.
Right. So now what's supposed to happen, in your
opinion? Then the Court of Appeals can say that the decision, given that there is no longer a conviction under the continuing criminal enterprise statute, mm-hmm. there is no longer a double jeopardy bar, mm-hmm. and so we reverse the vacatur order, mm-hmm. and we remand to the...
But we reverse the... In other words, the government had to file a piece of paper called cross appeal? Because you won't care. I mean, as far as you're concerned, you're representing your client. You won't care. So what they were supposed to do is they're supposed to file a cross appeal from the vacatur order, and so that then they're protected?
I don't believe that would be necessary, but...
But I want to know what's supposed to happen, so let me leave you alone and you'll tell me.
Okay. All right. I don't believe that, because typically from a final judgment order, all orders entered in the case are brought before the Court of Appeals, I don't believe that the government would have to file a notice of appeal.
I am now an appellate court judge. And I've just reversed the 848 conviction because of the lack of that final element. And now I say to you, now please tell me, what do I do now? I'm new at this. I want to know how to do it.
Well, the vacatur is no longer valid because there's no longer a double jeopardy bar to the entry of a judgment of conviction on the conspiracy, the lesser included. And so you reverse the vacatur and you remand to the district court with instructions to enter judgment, assuming that there is no prejudice that inhered as a result of the...
And they don't have to have appealed.
They don't have to have appealed, but you have the authority to do that.
But then does your client appeal again from the second judgment so that can be reviewed for possible error?
In the typical case, and this has happened in 25 years so infrequently that there aren't a lot of examples to cite to, but in the typical case, the only thing that the district court would do would be to enter judgment and then issue a sentence, and the only question really left for appeal would be the propriety of the sentence.
Well, but wouldn't your client have a right to claim some sort of error, perhaps, in the instructions in the case of the judgment that's now been entered against him? You wouldn't have been able to argue that on the previous appeal.
I believe not only would we have, but it would have been incumbent upon us to argue all error.
Yes, but not all of the errors might have been the basis for the decision. Let's assume that on the continuing criminal enterprise count, some element other than the conspiracy element was found to be insufficiently supported by evidence, and the court says, that's enough, we reverse. Then we get back to the position that you posit. The other conviction, the conspiracy conviction, is brought forward. I presume at that point you would say, I now want to appeal this because there was insufficient evidence of conspiracy.
Well, I don't think it's that complicated because you have to...
Well, no, but just tell me, why won't you... I mean, you're not going to concede that on behalf of your client.
Oh, no.
And if, in fact, it was not reached by the appellate court as the grounds of its decision... In the first appeal, you're going to want to reach it in the second one, because if you do, your client will walk. So, of course, you're going to want to appeal
it. That's true, but I will want to appeal, because the conspiracy claim is a true lesser-included offense. I will want to raise every issue with respect to that, too, because every...
And you will raise every issue, but in my example, the appellate court says, we find one ground of error. We don't have to get into the question of the sufficiency of evidence on conspiracy. That's difficult. So we're going to decide it on the ground of the clear error. So you will have done everything you're supposed to do. But because the court decided on the ground that it did, you will still have the conspiracy issue before you, and you're going to appeal it, aren't you?
Yes, although I would
say... So there will be, I mean, we've got to assume that the price to be paid here is a second appeal.
Well, yes, at some level. I don't think it will be that complicated in a second appeal because the same court that you're talking about...
But what sense does it make? If you say that it doesn't have to be a retrial on the conspiracy, why have two appeals instead of just one? As long as there's not going to be additional collateral consequences, as Justice Breyer indicated, doesn't it make entire sense to let the whole case go up to the Court of Appeals and just ensure that there will be no more than one punishment?
Well, I guess I don't agree with the underlying premise that there are no collateral consequences because Ball clearly recognized the social...
But if you lose on the stigma point, there are none. Isn't that fair to say? If we say, look, there is no cognizable extra stigma when you have a mere lesser-included offense, then you really wouldn't have an answer to Justice Ginsburg's question, would you?
Justice Souter, you're absolutely correct with respect to a situation other than the one that is in our case where the Seventh Circuit has affirmed concurrent sentences, concurrent judgments, separate judgments and separate concurrent sentences. In our case, there was never a vacation of either offense. And so the argument to this point has been talking about preferred approach to take, but has not really addressed what's happened in our case. In our case, the Seventh Circuit affirmed separate convictions and affirmed concurrent sentences.
But if it's so, that under that Seventh Circuit judgment, there is no greater exposure to recidivist charges because under the guidelines they will be treated the same as if there had been only a CCE conviction, so that there is no recidivist consequence, then under the Seventh Circuit decision, and there's no longer prison term, the only consequence is the extra stigma.
No, I disagree.
$50.
Excuse me?
$50.
Well, there is the assessment of $50. There is, in addition, there are certain other collateral consequences that may adhere. First of all, there is the question of potential future impeachment, and the fact that my client may be in prison does not mean that he will not...
Or three strikes and you're outlaw in a state.
Yes.
I assume if there are two convictions rather than a merged one, it would count for two. Is that right?
Yes, that is also a possibility.
Raised that in connection with your client. How many convictions did your client have?
Well, depending on whether you count both, it would be five or six in this case.
And there were indeed three life sentences, were there not?
Yes.
So does the way this particular case is decided, does it have any practical consequences given that your client has not two but three life sentences at the moment?
Well, I think the answer to that, Justice Ginsburg, is that I don't know. I mean, and nobody sitting here today can project that far into the future to know.
Let me ask you kind of a basic question that reveals my ignorance. This lesser-included offense situation where a person is charged with a greater offense and a lesser in the same proceeding, that must happen quite frequently in the state courts, doesn't it?
Well, generally in the state courts, at least in Illinois, charges aren't made on a separate basis. You would charge for an aggravated battery, for instance, and... the question would come up at the end of the case whether to submit jury instructions on the lesser included of battery and assault.
Supposing you do have the jury instructions for a greater and a lesser included offense in the same case, what does the judge do? Does he enter two judgments? I mean, what is the...
I believe that the jury, at least in my state, is instructed to do one or the other, so the problem does not come up.
But why wouldn't the proper solution here be the same, to have them do one or the other?
Well, it would make sense to me, but I believe that the Ball case said that the jury verdict, that you can bring back and return a jury verdict on both.
I mean, it seems sort of strange to have a very special rule of lesser-included offenses in the federal court that's different from what's
applied all over the country in state courts.
Well, I don't disagree that this creates the problem. This is the situation of the government charging both the lesser and the greater.
But is this a lesser-included offense case? Is this a lesser-included offense case? I thought the position was that there were two different acts. One was a conspiracy, the other was a very successful conspiracy.
Well, but...
Not necessarily. You know, the only reason it's lesser included is because there's a lesser punishment.
No, Your Honor. I think it's important to point out that every continuing criminal enterprise will have embedded within it a conspiracy, because one of the statutory elements, without looking to the facts of the case or anything, a pure Blockberger analysis, is in concert. The conduct has to be in concert. And so there will always be a conspiracy buried in a continuing criminal enterprise.
Well, yes, but we've conceded at the outset, I thought we conceded that they could be punished separately and cumulatively if Congress so intended.
That's true. And our position
is... And that is not a paradigmatic lesser-included offense.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
In that situation, you do not have a paradigmatic lesser-included offense.
That's true, but Congress did not intend for pyramiding sentences here. The government agrees that Congress did not intend for pyramiding sentences. The government's position
But wouldn't you agree that Congress could pyramid sentences with lesser included and greater offenses?
Yes.
Sure.
So why isn't this a paradigm? I don't understand why this is not a paradigm, whatever the word is. Conspiracy is always a lesser included offense of the CCE.
Well, I guess in my waning moments, perhaps I sort of leapfrogged to an issue I was hoping to get to address, which is Congress's intent.
Well, before you do that,
yes.
I don't understand what you said about the state case. Why is it okay to send it to the jury? You say no harm is done if you, so long as there's an instruction at the end. What if, in fact, the jury convicts of aggravated assault, and it turns out on appeal that there's not enough evidence to support the aggravation part? If the lesser included offenses have not been submitted to the jury, he walks, I assume, right?
My understanding is that, and I have seen cases in which there were reversals and remand for a trial on the lesser included.
Oh, for retrial, I'm sure he can be retried.
Yes.
But why wouldn't it be better to submit both to the jury so that if the one conviction is reversed, the other one would stand, as you're arguing would be the case here?
To be honest with you, I don't know. Okay. It's not how the Illinois law has...
In the state court case you hypothesized, that you explained, the jury returns a verdict on only one of the two charges,
right.
Not both.
Yes.
But here they do both, so that's different from the standard lesser-included offense analysis. Lesser-included offense, the jury has a choice of one or the other. Here, the government is entitled to require a jury verdict on both.
The same was true with respect to the two firearm statutes in Ball. They were separate offenses. They were both submitted. This court held that specifically that both could be submitted to the jury. The verdicts could be returned. Nevertheless, it was clear that the possession statute was a lesser-included of the receipt statute, and this court, in examining the statutory history, the statutory structure and the legislative history, came to the conclusion that Congress did not intend to accumulate punishments. And based upon that conclusion, said, because of the collateral consequences issue, that you could not enter cumulative sentences, even if they're concurrent. The same situation presented itself in United States versus Gaddis, which was a bank robbery case. And the jury returned verdicts under 2113A, 2113B, and 2113D. And this court, in its footnote, said, well, obviously you're going to have to vacate the separate convictions and the concurrent sentences for all but the 2113D. So I think within the federal system, perhaps it was unfortunate I even interjected my state, but within the federal system, it is not unusual to submit lesser included and the greater offense at the same time.
In Ball, you say, was lesser included. I thought that they were so close to the same offense. Why do you characterize those as lesser in the possession as lesser included?
Because in order to receive, you have to possess, but in order to possess, you do not have to receive. And the Chief Justice Berger, in writing that case, noted in a footnote that one way of doing that would be for the person who possesses the gun to manufacture it, you know, the zap gun situation. But there is a much more frequent occurrence that distinguishes those two statutes, and that is somebody who is not a felon goes out, buys a gun, happens all the time, commits a felony, is convicted, and, you know, upon his release returns home to his gun collection. Now, every one of those guns is illegally possessed, but not one of them was illegally received. And so there you have, that is the situation, it's a virtually identical situation here where there's an lesser included offense.
What actually is your objection to what I take as the SG's position on our piece of paper called Judgment in the District Court? The District Court would write 846, conviction, 848, conviction, and then between the two he'd write the words 846 is included as part of the, or something like that.
Yes.
Or merged into, I don't know. I mean, he'd write some extra words between those two pieces of paper, and that would signal to everybody. Lawyers see the word conviction, they know they have to appeal. So they'd have a signal, appeal both. And the words in between those two things would apparently make clear to everybody, we'd hope, with an opinion of this court, that the collateral consequences don't apply. Do you have an objection to that approach?
I would certainly prefer it to the approach taken by the Seventh Circuit in this case. Okay. Beyond that, I still believe, as I started out the morning, that the vacatur approach is better because that way there is no question but that there is only one conviction for one offense. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Levenstam. Mr. Feldman, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, it is a consequence of petitioner's position that a defendant who is validly found guilty by a jury of two very serious federal offenses, drug conspiracy and CCE, should have the opportunity under some circumstances to gain a windfall. If he's able to have the CCE conviction, since the district court under petitioner's position may only enter judgment on the CCE offense, if on appeal he's able to have that conviction overturned, the defendant will obtain the possibility of going free, notwithstanding that he's committed the drug conspiracy offense, that he's been validly charged of that offense before a jury.
Is that any different from any normal lesser-included offense situation in which the government gets the verdict on the greater offense and the defendant appeals and has it set aside? He walks on the entire transaction.
I have two answers to that. First, I don't think that is the ordinary case. In the ordinary case of a simple greater and lesser-included offense, where they're defined in a single statutory section and they're increasing aggravating factors of the same series of offenses. In that situation, the normal practice is you can, if the greater offense is overturned, the court can enter judgment on the lesser offense, assuming the reason for overturning the greater doesn't cast any doubt on the jury's finding that the defendant committed all of the elements of the lesser.
Do you have at hand authority that I could look at?
Yeah, there's the case we actually cited in our brief, the case from this court that's a little bit obscure, but actually is normally cited for that proposition, is Tinder against the United States. Actually, a commonly cited case from the D.C. Circuit that lays that out is Allison against the United States at 409 F. Second 445. There's a recent Second Circuit case, U.S. v. Boissonneau at 926 F. Second 230, and there are some others.
Well, if that's the general rule, why wouldn't that rule apply here?
Well,
just enter judgment on the greater offense.
Well, that ordinarily is what happened is what the normal federal practice is, where, as I said, where separate offenses are defined in distinct sections of a single statute with aggravating factors. And
Back up just a second. Is it correct that it's common ground here that the conspiracy offense is a lesser-included offense in this case?
We're willing to assume that for purposes of this case. If it were necessary for the court's decision, we don't agree with that proposition.
But if that were true, then shouldn't this be treated just like any other lesser-included offense situation?
Well, it's not the way it's ordinarily done when statutes have as complex a relationship as the two statutes do.
But maybe
here,
it would simplify things to do it that way. That's the question I'm asking. I realize there's been a lot of confusion with these two statutes, but if we made it clear that one is a lesser-included of the other, wouldn't that solve everything?
Well, it would be one way of addressing the problem. I would agree with that.
What would be wrong with it? You just put it in harmony with all our other lesser included offense law.
The basis of the normal way of treating things, as you mentioned, is that it's assumed that when Congress puts aggravating factors of a given offense in a particular statute, that Congress only wants one conviction. And in fact, the way it's normally submitted to the jury is told to first consider the greater, and then only if it finds a defendant not guilty of that should it go down and consider each of the others. And it's in that, due to long practice and the way things have been done, it's assumed that when Congress defines...
But the reason it hasn't been done here is there's been a debate of very realistic arguments on both sides as to whether these are, in fact, entirely separate offenses. What did Congress intend? But if we assume, as everybody's been assuming in the argument up to now, that you lose on that issue, then wouldn't it make sense to just put it in the same pattern? Of course, I understand you don't want to concede that. But.
Well, I don't think so, because I think that the question is what Congress intended, and where Congress defines statutes in two distinct sections of statutes, and moreover, where it takes an offense like CCE, which is really dramatically different from an underlying conspiracy, which involves the defendant obtaining substantial income, acting in concert with five or more people, committing a series of violations. When it takes that kind of statute,
that's
it's not unreasonable.
Murder is more serious than assault, too.
It's true, and Congress could if Congress's intent were not to treat murder and assault the same way as this, then that would be a reasonable
first
way
for us to decide what Congress's intent was. And if we agree with you, well, then they're totally separate. But if we disagree with you, then why does it make any difference that they're in separate statutes rather than in one?
If we
agree with you that Congress intended two separate proceedings entirely, then you win, period. But if we disagree and think that they did intend one to be a lesser included offense of the other, even though they're in separate provisions of the code, then why shouldn't they be treated just like a normal lesser included offense?
If they were treated like normal lesser included offenses, and if it were made clear that the procedure whereby you, if the greater one were reversed, that the court could just enter judgment on the lesser one, so long as the reason for the reversal didn't cast any doubt on the jury's finding of guilty of the lesser one. I mean,
what did this court say in Ball that sheds light on this, do you think?
I think the Ball court had two holdings, both of which we agree with. The first holding was that the entry of a conviction and the entry of a concurrent sentence does in itself constitute some modicum of punishment, albeit perhaps not as much punishment as a longer prison term or a substantially larger fine, but some modicum of punishment.
Will indicate that the conspiracy is a lesser included offense of CCE, in your view?
No, Your Honor, maybe you're referring to the Jeffers case. In Ball did not deal, I was going to get to the other holding in Ball, was that the two offenses at issue there, receipt of a firearm by a felon and possession of a firearm by a felon, were essentially to be treated as directed at a single evil and as the same offense.
Was
and again,
it Jeffers where we discussed?
Yeah, Jeffers was the previous case that involved CCE and conspiracy. The plurality in that case stated that Congress didn't intend a greater prison term to be imposed or a greater fine. They didn't intend that kind of pyramiding of punishments or consecutive punishments to be imposed.
And the plurality in Jeffers assumed without deciding that there was a lesser included offense?
That's correct. But they still went on, and we're submitting this case to the court and willing to accept the same assumption that the court adopted in Jeffers, and that is we can assume they're a greater and lesser included offense, but there still remains the question of what Congress intended. Jeffers stands for the proposition, at least the plurality opinion in Jeffers, that Congress intended not to impose a greater prison term or a more substantial fine. But Jeffers didn't address the question of whether this modicum of additional punishment that's caused merely by the entry of a judgment and a concurrent sentence, whether that was something that Congress would have imposed. In our
whether this is a lesser included offense or not.
The court could decide that in this case. It would be our submission that it's not a lesser included offense because the CCE offense doesn't require, although it may be satisfied by proof of a classic conspiracy, the in concert with element doesn't require proof of a conspiracy. It only requires that the defendant act together with a number of other people to organize an enterprise, but it doesn't require that the other people who are involved with the defendant necessarily know the criminal goals or the full criminal goals of the enterprise. If a defendant, for example, organizes a business to transport merchandise from some country where drugs are prevalent to the United States and does so in a fairly a shady and unusual way, there may be other people who join with him, possibly even thinking it's an innocent enterprise, or possibly not, but who don't know that in every one of those shipments is a large amount of cocaine. In that kind of a case, we think it's reasonable to say that the defendant acted in concert with the other five individuals, even though they couldn't all be found guilty of conspiracy. For that reason, and this was an argument also that we submitted in Jefferson, the court didn't reach, for that reason, we don't think that it's a classic relationship of greater and lesser included
offenses. In that case you give, you wouldn't have a conspiracy indictment.
Right. In that case,
sure.
I mean, you wouldn't.
Every assault isn't a lesser included offense of every murder. It depends on the facts of the case.
That's correct. And in that case,
if the conspiracy is an element of the CCE, then it's always a lesser included offense.
No, I don't think that's the analysis.
Your example doesn't disagree with that.
No, I don't think that's right. You don't look at whether on the facts of a particular case, whether the defendant was not only guilty of the conspiracy but also the CCE. Just what you look at is whether under the statute it's possible to be guilty of the CCE without being guilty of the conspiracy. And is our position, because of the example I just gave, that that is possible, that if the court had to reach the question.
We deal with cases in which the only cases we're concerned with are those in which the government has made both a conspiracy charge and a CCE charge. So it doesn't help the analysis to hypothesize CCE cases that don't involve conspiracy.
I think I agree with you in the following sense. I think what my example showed was that they are, in fact, distinct offenses. But in any event, the question is what Congress intended for defendants in the position of petitioner here.
How could we resolve Jeffers the way we did against the government and not reach this issue, as you say?
Because the court in Jeffers held that in any event, what you have to do is look at Congress's intent with respect to...
Well, isn't it very relevant to Congress's intent whether whether one crime is a lesser included offense or not?
I think, actually, in many cases it is, although the court frequently, when it deals with that question, looks not only at the relation of lesser greater included offenses, but also looks at what direct indications of how Congress intended.
Did we say in Jeffers that we were not reaching this question?
Yes, the court specifically said it, I think, two or three times in the course of its opinion. And actually, the court didn't have an opinion in Jeffers. I should correct myself. There was only the plurality opinion that even proceeded along this line of reasoning. Justice White wrote an opinion in which he said they were not greater and lesser included offenses, and therefore any kind of accumulation of punishment would have been permissible in his view.
To me it's a very, very fine congressional intent you're asking us to posit. I don't like talking about congressional intent anyway. It seems to me you look at the statute and see what the statute reasonably means. But you say there's one class of we can discern a congressional intent not to pyramid punishments, however, to accumulate convictions. So there are three categories of statutes. You can accumulate both, and then category two, you can pyramid punishments but not convictions, and category three, you can't pyramid either one. And where to discern this refined congressional intent statute by statute?
Well, I think
it's a real difficult task, don't you think?
Well, that is what the court, I think that's what the court did in Ball. It looked at those two particular statutes in that case to determine what Congress intended with respect to
those. But I think the one goes with the other. I think when Congress doesn't intend to pyramid punishments, it doesn't intend to pyramid convictions either. That's my point. I think it's a very refined congressional intent to allow the double punishment but not allow the double conviction or vice versa.
I think, to be fair, it's also...
I guess there are even more than three categories. Maybe sometimes they want to allow two convictions but not two punishments. Sometimes they want to allow two punishments but not two convictions. We're going to have to go through the whole list, aren't we?
Well, I mean, I think as a logical matter, it's possible Congress could have had any kind of intent with respect to punishment because the Constitution doesn't impose limits in that respect.
Well,
as a practical matter...
I can't figure all of this out. I mean, if it's... The two are accumulated or not, and if they're accumulated, you can neither punish twice nor you can convict twice. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, as a practical matter, the notion of punishment that's involved here is a fairly involved, refined notion of punishment. I mean, it's... merely having the piece of paper say that you got convicted of both crimes and concurrent sentences, in this case concurrent life sentences, don't really impose the kind of disability on a defendant that the separate an additional term of years in prison or an additional fine would have imposed. And when you're working with such refined notions of punishment, I think it's important to also try to figure out whether the Congress wouldn't have wanted that kind of refined notion of punishment to get in the way of what is surely one of its primary goals, which is seeing to it that a defendant who commits and is convicted of both Section 846 conspiracy and a Section 848 CCE, that defendant receives the punishment that Congress intended for both offenses, regardless of some fluke of later judicial procedure.
What's the source of this refined concept of punishment that you were just talking about. Are there cases from this court that suggest it?
The only case that I'm aware of is Ball. In fact, the only case is Ball, is United States against Ball.
It isn't entirely consistent with some of our other cases, is it?
Ball is in some tension with a number of cases. Yeah. But the Ball had a fairly unique circumstance, which was you had two statutes of receiving and possessing a firearm by a felon. The court basically treated them as if they're really two ways of committing the same offense. As the court said in its opinion, there's one evil that Congress was legislating against there. And in fact, a year after the decision in Ball, Congress in fact took the two statutes, which really by happenstance were just codified separately, and combined them into what's now 18 U.S.C. 922H.
But Mr. Feldman, Chief Justice Burger said twice in that opinion, said the criminal conviction itself, and not just the sentence, is punishment. And he stated that, I'm sure you're familiar with the decision, twice as a perfectly general proposition, not tied to this peculiar receipt possession.
I agree, and again, we don't disagree, or we're not asking the court our position doesn't require disagreeing with that holding. It's only that it does perhaps suggest that there should be a recognition that the kind of punishment that's imposed merely, especially in a case like this, merely by the entry of an extra judgment and a concurrent sentence is not the kind of punishment is one that Congress would have intended to avoid the problem that was being addressed during petitioner's argument, which is the possibility that a defendant is going to gain a windfall and not receive a prison sentence for a drug conspiracy that he committed. I would also add that it's even less of a punishment than it was in Ball. Now, at the time of Ball, there was parole in the federal system. There is no parole. And one of the things that Chief Justice Burger referred to was the possibility that the extra conviction could have an effect on a parole decision. Well, in fact, under CCE, there never has been parole. So that's
but if the Tinder case that you cited, if that's the model, then the government is protected against what you said at the outset of your argument was your real concern.
That's correct.
It could be stuck without any conviction.
That's correct.
I'm not sure that's so, because in Tinder, what happens, I've just read it, the court gave a sentence that was in excess of the authorized sentence unless they showed that the value of the item stolen from the mail had been more than $5,000. The court just made a mistake. There had been no proof that the value was over $5,000. So this court said, well, you just have to sentence for the lesser amount because it wasn't shown. That's all that was. The offense was the same. The question was whether or not the sentence could stand.
Well,
the offense was the same offense.
The way Tinder has been read by the lower courts, and this court did not discuss this issue in any detail, as you know, but the way it's been read by the lower courts as the greater offense required proof of over whatever it was, over $5,000 of merchandise stolen, and that was an element of the greater offense. There was a felony. There was also a misdemeanor offense that didn't require proof of that element, and therefore the relationship between the two offenses was as greater and lesser included offense. But if it were clear that Tinder would apply in that situation, the government's primary interest here is in seeing to it that a defendant who's convicted of both under both statutes receives the punishment that Congress intended for both.
A lot of that has to be implied from Tinder, doesn't it? Since it really goes from a long recitation of the facts to saying reversed.
That's correct. But it's the disposition of, it's not just reversed, it's also the disposition of the case, which was entry of judgment on the misdemeanor. But I agree. Nonetheless, Tinder has been taken by the lower courts to mean that. I think the Seventh Circuit's approach is the simplest way of achieving the result of making sure that the defendant who commits both offenses receives a punishment that Congress intended for both. Now, the Second Circuit's approach is another way of accomplishing the same objective. And although it's slightly, if the court disagrees with our submission that Congress didn't intend and believes that Congress didn't intend separate convictions and concurrent sentences, the appropriate thing to do would be deal with a case like the Second Circuit does, which is to enter one judgment of conviction and make it clear on the judgment that a single conviction is being entered for a violation of the two statutes and a single sentence is being entered.
Mr. Feldman, what light do you think that Garrett versus the United States sheds on this problem? There the court dealt with what? A CCE offense and a predicate offense.
That's correct. And the court stated that the relationship between those two offenses is a very complex relationship, and it cannot be simply analogized to a greater and that of greater and lesser included offenses. Near the end of its opinion, it cited the Jeffers case once, but the point of that citation and what it said about Jeffers was simply, we're not dealing today with an issue dealing with a conspiracy offense based on the same agreement. We're dealing with the relationship between an individual criminal predicate offense, which can be one of any number that can be a predicate for CCE and the CCE offense itself. And the court held in that case that not only could a defendant be separately punished, a defendant could be separately prosecuted for those two. But I think really the only relevance of Garrett is that it recognized that that wasn't the issue that it was dealing with in that, the court was dealing with in that case. As I was saying, the Second Circuit's approach has no possible consequences that would inure to the defendant's detriment. There's only one conviction, there's only one sentence, and there's under this court's decision in Ball, there's nothing wrong with a judgment of conviction that was entered the way the Second Circuit does. Since that, the Second Circuit's approach would also make it clear that the defendant has to bring all of his issues to the appellate court in the very first appeal of the conviction.
And you think it's a lesser punishment to say I have two convictions of two crimes than to say I have one conviction of two crimes? And it seems to me the court that said in Ball that that two convictions are punishment, you know, is cumulative punishment, would also say that a conviction of two crimes is cumulative punishment, don't you?
I don't think so, because I think that Ball was concerned not just with the very abstract question of counting of crimes, but the possible consequences that could flow to the defendant from two convictions, and those consequences can't flow. In other words, Ball can't flow from merely the entry of a single conviction. Ball didn't hold that the entry of two convictions, if it had no collateral consequences whatsoever, would still, just as a matter of stigma, constitute punishment that has to be dealt with.
You think it's stigmatically neutral?
I guess I would think it's stigmatically neutral. I think in particularly in the context of these statutes where the CCE offense is really one of the most serious ones in the federal criminal law, the fact that a defendant was convicted of a single conviction, convicted once of violating CCE and a drug conspiracy statute, I don't think carries any additional stigma.
Could you help me with something very, very basic? So assume no knowledge on my part. Very basic. What happens in the absolute ordinary case in the federal courts where you have crime A and everyone agrees that crime A is a lesser included offense of crime B? Now, how do you instruct the jury? You instruct the jury in the ordinary Hornbook basic case that they can convict of both, or do you tell the jury you can convict of A only if you acquit of B?
It's the latter is the ordinary way of dealing it. Where the two...
The latter is the ordinary way. So ordinarily, the basic Hornbook thing is that you'll end up with one conviction, and if that conviction is reversed on appeal, you'll have to have a new trial.
No, I don't think that's correct. I think because it depends. But if you get if the conviction is for the greater offense,
and if it gets convicted for a reason
that's unrelated to the lesser offense, then you can just enter conviction on the lesser.
How could you if the jury never came in with the conviction?
I beg your pardon?
Sorry, if you instruct the jury, convict of B. If you convict of B, you can't convict of A.
Right, in ordinary,
lesser included.
That's correct.
And now they do convict of B. On appeal, reversed. You have to have a new trial, don't you?
No, I don't think that that's correct. I think under the Tinder case, and at least the way the Tinder case has been understood by the lower courts, the court can simply go back and enter judgment, and in fact should just enter judgment on the lesser included offense. The jury has found the defendant guilty of all
right.
of the elements.
If that's so, fine. If that's so, why does the government care if we adopt their position? That is, if it's a lesser included offense, then we'd simply behave as normal. The government must care because you're trying to save the possibility. What is it that I don't understand?
I would say our primary interest in this case is making sure that whatever mechanism is involved, the defendant who has committed both the 846 and 848 offenses can't, through some fluke on collateral attack or appeal, by getting one of those overturned for a reason unrelated to the other, doesn't therefore end up...
You've just explained to me how that is impossible. You've just explained it to me. You said...
In the normal course of a statute that defines greater and lesser degrees of a single offense, committing an offense and then committing the same offense with a gun or something like that, I think that that's the way Congress intended things to work. I do think that where Congress defined the statutes entirely independently and included...
But that's a legal argument. I'm interested in why you care about it. That is, from what you just said, if I were to write down your very words, and it turned out you're right about how this is normally so, and it also turned out that this is a less included offense of a normal sort, you would therefore, if I wrote down your very words you just told me, have what you want. Isn't that so?
I think, actually, yes. Yes, in the sense that if it were clear that that was a procedure that would work in these kinds of cases,
yeah,
that would protect the interest that the government is seeking here. I think.
And so then what we should say, in your view, is almost, I think, identical to what your opponent told us. We should say this is a lesser included offense. This is how the lesser included offense works. And then say what you said?
We do, well, we do disagree that it is a lesser included
offense. No, but if we say it's a lesser included offense, you get everything you want, don't you?
If it's clear that that procedure would work, at least in terms of our, again, I don't think this is what Congress intended here, but in terms of our interests,
let's assume we'll commit that error, and we'll say Congress did intend these to be treated as greater and lesser included. Then there's nothing else that you're worried about, is there? There's no broader point.
So long as it was clear, again, that the defendant who somehow managed to get the CCE conviction overturned on direct or on collateral attack, the judgment could still be entered on the lesser, on the conspiracy offense.
Well, I think that was Justice Breyer's.
Right. But I just want to be sure that that is our primary interest. So as long as that was clear, then that would accommodate that interest.
But
for the reasons I said before, I really do want to add that we don't view them as greater and lesser included offenses. And in our view,
you're basically making the argument that Justice White accepted in Jeffers now, and 8 members of the court made the assumption to the contrary. They didn't rule it. But if we took the suggestion Justice Breyer made, we'd really have the precedent of the assumption made by 8 members of the court in Jeffers.
Well, I think actually you'd have 4 members. There are 4 members of the court who I think accepted the assumption. It didn't make merely the assumption, but would have held that. There are another 4 members of the court who did assume it, but I don't think that you can take much weight from the fact that 4 members of the court were willing to assume that, since they found it didn't make any difference for that case.
No, but if White was right, his has a much simpler disposition of the case than the rather convoluted position of the majority.
Well, I think that the plurality of the court in that case was, it's true they didn't accept Justice White's view. They also didn't accept the view of the concurring opinion either.
But all of this is one who joined the convoluted plurality. I must say, when the opinion says we assume something, I don't figure we're deciding it. I figure we're reserving it.
Right. I think it was because the court believed it was, because the plurality believed it was a difficult question, that it did assume it, and it found that in that case it could resolve the question simply by referring to congressional.
But if we were to decide the case that way, we would have to, in order to reach this happy result that's been suggested to you, I think we would have to confirm the correctness of the D.C. Circuit's opinion in the Allison case, which said that without a jury verdict on the lesser included offense, the court could order a judgment on that defense. And that seems to me to be something we have not yet decided.
Again, it has been taken to be, and I've been cautious in how I word this throughout, that's been taken to be the holding of Tinder, and I don't really think that Tinder can be read to mean anything else. It is the general practice of the courts of appeals. I can't say that it's totally secure.
The court of appeals enters judgment in the court of appeals on an offense which the defendant was not convicted of by the jury, because the jury very likely would have convicted
it. It's really more than that. It's that the defendant, the jury necessarily found that the defendant committed all of the elements of that offense. And then what the issue in the Court of Appeals is some element that doesn't have to do with that offense. So in a very real sense, the jury has convicted him of a crime, and the jury has found him guilty of all of the elements of the offense.
Yes.
And I think the proposition is that having done that, there's no reason why the Court of Appeals, generally what it does, it remands and orders the district court to enter judgment on the lesser included offense.
Mr. Feldman, if we don't make what you regard as the error of treating these two offenses as greater and lesser, then, in fact, there would, I suppose, be a further stigmatic element, quite apart from the $50, in the conviction for conspiracy, since that need not be, on your view, assumed under CCC. And so if we read the law right, why shouldn't you lose just on straightforward analysis of cumulative effect?
I guess this court has never gone so far as to hold that level of effect really constitutes a punishment that in any real sense should determine, should guide the analysis, or in particular should stand in the way of reaching what I think is a logical Seventh Circuit result here.
Gall could be read to say just that.
I beg your pardon?
Gall could be read to say just that. That the very conviction is additional punishment, and one of the reasons is the stigma.
Right, but Ball said that only after going that one. It said there is some modicum of additional punishment that attaches to a conviction in the circumstance where both there was both the possibility of adverse collateral effects and this kind of stigmatic injury. But then Ball said that in this case, we're only holding that the conviction has to be reversed, and we're only holding that the and the sentence can't be entered because of the particular relationship between the two statutes here. It requires a determination.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman.
Thank you.
Mr. Levenstein, you have 2 minutes remaining.
Thank you. With respect to the Jeffers...
Mr. Livingston, I'm sorry, but would you address something? I was going to ask Mr. Feldman this. What's the significance of the $50 here?
Well, under this court's per curiam decision in Ray, there really are no longer concurrent sentences in the federal system because each judgment of conviction carries with it a separate $50 assessment.
So the $50, at least in your view, is punishment. It's not some administratively neutral user fee for being sentenced or something like
yes.
that.
Yes. The statute 3013 says it's to be collected as if it were a criminal fine, and this court's decision in Ray clearly indicated that this was not there were no longer concurrent sentences in the federal system. With respect to Jeffers, while the court was willing to assume for that case the status of the conspiracy as a lesser included, what it did not assume and what question it specifically answered was what it called the critical inquiry, whether Congress intended to punish these two statutes separately. And the answer there was no. And that answer was not only shared by the four members of the plurality, but I believe my reading, if you look at footnote 5 of Justice Stevens' concurrence, he said there were two punishments imposed unconstitutionally as well. So eight justices there, regardless of the lesser included issue, said specifically Congress did not intend to punish violations of 846 and 848 separately.
Mr. Levenstein, what is your position on the Tinder approach? That is, CCE only conviction, appellate court can remand with instructions to enter a conviction on the conspiracy count.
Assuming that you can interject the Morris versus Matthews analysis, which is if there has been some prejudice to the defendant as a result of the charging of the greater offense, then we would agree with that, with the Tinder approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levenstein. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.